lecture 26. How many do you have a week?
Three. Three lectures and a tutorial every week. And lab sessions.
And how many courses do you have?
Well, the same as everybody. I mean, this is a 20-point course.
Yes.
So, and they have to do 120 credits.
See, for our 40-point courses, we have one lecture.
Gosh.
So.
No wonder our students complain. You're doing joint philosophy, right? Or are you just doing it as an outside thing?
It's cognitive science. So it's
oh, are you?
Not even the joint.
No, no, no. But you, yeah. So you've chosen the philosophy track in Cog Sci, have you?
Yeah. Well, we that's important.
Cool.
It's funny though how people. I mean, I studied psychology in Slovenia for a year, and the system there is completely different. We'd have like 9 hours of lectures a week for one course.
Wow.
Yeah.
Spoon fed.
Yeah, and seven courses per semester.
My God, you don't have time to think.
Yeah, I mean not all of the courses will have that amount of lectures, but it's just I don't know. I hear people complain here when they have 3 or 4 exams per semester.
And you're like luxury. Yes, here.
Yeah, but there's usually just one person, so it really depends on when the lecturer has time. That's when you'll have the exam, so it's not central. It's like which also means everybody cheats and everybody's over.
Yeah.
Which is kind of weird.
Where are you from? Is this Bulgaria?
Slovenia.
Slovenia.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know about Slovenia, but we've got lots of Bulgarians, and they're all brilliant. Really good mathematicians. I don't know how they teach them maths, but my God, they're good at maths.
See,
and logic.
It's just that in the UK they're really bad at maths.
Okay, are you Bulgarian?
No.
Right, just wondering.
I'm not from the UK either.
Did they teach maths
about
that?
Yes.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Okay,
it's recipe based. There's no understanding of the underlying concepts and I mean, computing as it's taught in schools as well is appalling, appalling.
It's about resources on computing.
Yeah, it's how to consume applications, right? It's how to write a document in Word and use a spreadsheet rather than how to write your own software to do what you want to do. Yeah, they are, yeah. But it's going to take years. But it's a nightmare teaching this kind of stuff at university level. Because, well, like the Germans aren't like that, right? So it's a very broad base of skills in the entry students.
Yeah.
Do you? Sympathize. I did a maths degree. But
a whole maths degree?
Yeah, my first degree is maths and philosophy. And then a PhD in Cog Sci.
Because I did physics at Oxford. For
right.
Year.
And then came here.
And then I tried to change to PE.
I was like that too. I was at Oxford and tried to change. It was easier to change university than change course. So, and I didn't like Oxford much anyway, so I left and went elsewhere. Because I was doing pure maths, and I wanted to do maths and philosophy, so I went to Durham in the end.
Which college were you
at? Mildred.
Counting even numbers is really just switching from one side to the other. And it's not so intuitive.
This is probably it. You should go ahead, because I've got a lot to get through, yeah.
Cool. Hi, guys. sorry to take up a few moments of your time. I'm actually here for Andrew Burney, who is your school rep currently for informatics for your school. And you might remember last year, hopefully some of you signed his petition, which was on trying to change the university's decision to reduce the number of weeks in which the exam period from 4 to 3. Now, we've just been talking here about the fact that actually people here have a lot more exams than I do. I have 3 exams most semesters. You guys sometimes have 11 or 12, which seems remarkable to me, but I guess normal to you guys. Obviously, reducing the size of that diet would negatively affect your guys' degrees, and I understand that completely, and that's why he ran that petition. And I actually think that the issue of that petition is actually much less important than how he did the process itself. And how he did it was, it came from students like you guys who have exams. And he said, and people came up to him as their school rep and said, actually, this is a problem and it's something I need sorted. And he decided, yeah, we'll run a campaign. Now, too often, you said at the moment, decided, did anyone here participate in anything in the week of action last week? Exactly, right? That was something that came down from top down. And I'm a member of the USA executive, so I know it came from the top down. We decided we're going to have a week of action without any consultation with students on loads of issues. And then we expected students to latch onto that. That's not the way that it should happen. It doesn't work. No one comes along. It has to happen how Andrew's petition happened, which is people, students, in their lectures, in their classes, going to their reps and saying, this is terrible. This is something we need to sort out. So please vote for Andrew Burney next week. Hopefully change a little bit the way that we do use that. Thanks very much.
All right. Okay. So, on to more probabilistic inference. We have until now looked at Bayesian networks, which are essentially a means of representing a moment in time, right? What they don't do is allow you to reason about, given that it's been rainy for the last 7 days, what's the weather going to be like today? Is it going to rain, right? A way of modeling an extended process. And so what we're going to do over the next few lectures is talk about uncertainty and time. In other words, what you need to do is work out a temporal sequence, the values of a temporal sequence of variables. Did it rain on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday? How do you work that out if you can't actually look out the window, for example, and see whether it's raining? Okay, now the basic idea here is really straightforward for going from a static environment, which is what a Bayesian network represents, to a dynamic environment, one in which the values of variables can change over time, like the value of the variable rain. It's true today, actually it's not true today, might be true tomorrow, especially here, right? What the conceptually, it's a very simple idea. Take, for example, a cloudy, rainy, sprinkly, wet grass thing, right? So we had Tuesday, I had a Bayesian network that looked like this, right? Now you think of that, so this is sprinkler, cloudy, rain, sprinkler, wet grass. And you think of that as a little time slice. And what you do is at the next time slice, you have the same network again, okay? But these two things aren't independent of each other, because if it was cloudy yesterday, that influences the likelihood of it being cloudy today. So you're gonna have some link like this, okay? With some probability on it, cloudy about cloudiness now given cloudiness before. That's just two time slices. What if I have a third? Now, is cloudiness today dependent on cloudiness yesterday and the day before? Well, maybe. And in fact, is the influence static over time or not? Maybe. Maybe not, right? So in the general case, all these probabilities that link past clouds to current clouds might be different over time. They might change over time. That's the fully general case, okay? But impossible to reason with in the end. So we're going to make some assumptions, about what we can model. And in particular, we are going to assume that a transition from one slice to another stays the same over time. That in the realm of weather is like saying there are no season changes, right? The probability that it's cloudy today and how it depends on past cloudiness is the same whatever month of the year you're in, okay? That's one assumption we're going to make. And the other is the degree of influence, how far back you've got to look for this direct influence. All right, so that's the general picture that I want you to have in mind as I go through the kind of abstract talk, okay? So you've got these time slices. You've got hidden variables, call them x of t, right? So this is cloudy of 0, cloudy of 1, cloudy of 2, right? A time slice 0, time slice 1, time slice 2. This is rain of 0, rain of 1, rain of 2, and so on, okay? Now, we've got some variables, so we've all our variables now are subscripted with time to reflect the fact that their values can vary over time. We're not in a static environment anymore where once it's assigned a value, that's it forever, right? Those values are going to vary over time. We've got our hidden guys, the X's, and the values of things that we can observe over time. And those values may change over time, but when they change, we know they've changed, right? Those are the evidence variables. So in our example, suppose we can look out the window and see grass, but not the weather, then W would be our evidence variable, okay? All right, so then at each day, what you want to do is work out your query given your evidence. So here's the example we're going to use. We're not going to use wet grass. We're going to use the example from Russell in Norvig, which is, imagine that you're down in some windowless basement and you want to know what the weather's doing outside. And the only thing you can observe, you're in a nuclear bunker or something. My mother-in-law, incidentally, bought a nuclear bunker last year. Anyway, very creepy. You're in this thing, you can't see the weather at all, and the only evidence you have about what the weather is whether your boss comes in every morning carrying an umbrella or not, because you know he has a penchant for going out with his umbrella if it's raining and not going out with his umbrella if it's not raining, but it's not entirely reliable because sometimes he thinks it's raining when it's not, and sometimes it is raining when he thinks it's not, and there's noise in the system. It's not a completely certain cause-effect relationship, but there's sort of noise in it. All right, so these are probabilistic links between umbrella carrying and rain. You can see the umbrella carrying, you can't see the rain, but what you want to know is whether it's raining, okay? Now, he does this every day, right? He comes in on a Monday with his umbrella. You think, oh, okay, probably raining today. The next day, he doesn't come in with his umbrella. Now, would you infer from that it's not raining today purely on the basis of that current evidence? No, because whether it was raining yesterday also influences whether it's raining today, at least in some parts of the world, if not Scotland, right? So you have to think about what your estimates are for that past hidden state, as well as the current evidence that you're observing when trying to estimate the current state. So typically then, what you're doing is you want to estimate the sequence of a value of a given variable, say A to B, given some evidence. So we notate that sequence with a subscript that looks like this. U1 to 3, for example, is the values of U1, U2, and U3. In other words, whether he brought his umbrella on day 1, day 2, and day 3. Okay, any questions so far? Okay, so how are we going to specify the dependencies here, right? It's natural to arrange them in temporal order. So we start here with day 1, and we head towards the right, day 2, day 3, day 4, and so on. Okay. And the problem with that is that time is unbounded.
And therefore, if you treat every time slice as an entire Bayesian network linked in some way to future Bayesian networks, it's unbounded. Because time is unbounded. Where do I stop this process? Right? So to make it practical, a method for doing practical reasoning, we make some assumptions. One of them these are the Markov assumptions, so-called, is that the whole thing is subject to what's known as a stationary process. In other words, the influence of the values of the past of a past state on the current state are the same whatever time slice you're in, right? So the influence of rain on Monday, the influence that has on rain on Tuesday is the same as the influence that rain on Tuesday has on rain on Wednesday. Doesn't matter where you are on the timeline, whether we're this week, next month, or 100 years from now, the influence from one time slice to the next is always the same. Okay? That's like making, I've lost my chalk. Now, in the general case, I wrote P. P here and P prime here. I can take off the prime. That's essentially what I'm saying. They're the same, okay? Now, that means that you can, the whole problem becomes bounded, and it's bounded by the degree of influence that direct influence that you need for the current guy, how far the direct influence goes back for the current guy. And that's another Markov assumption. What I've drawn here is what's known as a second order Markov assumption, because it's saying the current guy depends on the previous one and the one before that in a kind of direct manner. A first order Markov assumption would say it only depends on the previous guy. Okay? Now, it does depend. So here's rain on Wednesday, right? Here's rain, or cloudy, I should say. I'm assuming that the influence is coming from the clouds, and the current clouds only cause the rain, right? Here, this is cloudy on Wednesday, cloudy on Tuesday, cloudy on Monday. Whether it's cloudy on Monday or not does affect your estimates of clouds on Wednesday, but only in as much as it's mediated through this guy. Okay, so they are linked, but they're not directly linked in a first order model. Okay, we're essentially going to be looking at first order models. But anyway, here's, I think on the next slide, I've got the sort of diagram for the second order model, but we're going to deal with this kind of chat. Okay? Now, with that, so this is known as a first order Markov process. What we're modeling here is processes in time. This is like cloud flow, right, across the days. And given the clouds, that will affect the process of rain. Rain on Monday, rain on Tuesday, rain on Wednesday. Sprinkler, sprinkler, sprinkler. Or in our example, we're actually linking rain, whether it rained yesterday influences whether it rained today, and our evidence variable is umbrella, because rain causes umbrella, okay, which is the observed thing. Right, so this is diagrammatically, you're working in this kind of space, though, okay? And what I want to show you then, over the course of the next few lectures, is that just as a Bayesian network is a compact representation of everything you would ever want to know about the values of any combination of variables or any conditional probability or any query, the same is true of the dynamic Bayesian network. In fact, performing inference with these things is incredibly efficient because the maths works out as such that given the kinds of queries we're interested in, they are defined in terms of a recursive function.
right? You're typically interested in a value of a sequence of variables, say n sequences long. It turns out that that is always a weighted average of the n minus 1 sequence, weighted by these probabilities, these probabilities on these links. And because of that, computing a sequence of values, the likelihood of a sequence of values, however long, is linear. Hurrah, right? That's a brilliant result, which is why dynamic Bayesian networks are used in AI to model everything, anything that involves any notion of sequence. So in my field, in natural language processing, they're used for speech processing, automatic speech recognition and synthesis, part of speech tagging, parsing, word sense disambiguation, you name it, they're used for those, right? And that's why they're incredibly powerful tools. All right, so the other assumption that is made, I've implicitly put here, which is that the evidence you see now is dependent only on the hidden state now, and not on prior evidence, at least not directly, and not on prior states. Okay? So there's a conditional independence between what happens now and your hidden state now, and prior evidence given your hidden state. So that means that if your probability, if this is the joint probability you're interested in, I want to know the values of my hidden states, x1 to xt, and I want to know the value of my evidence variables, e1 to et. By the way, we always have to start with an initial setting for your hidden state because of this kind of picture. I need to have a kind of probability going out there, right? Then it is the product of each node given its parents. In the case of the hidden states, it's the prior states. In the case of the evidence variable, it's the current hidden variable. Okay? Just as it is in Bayesian networks. Because here it is, right? This is what it looks like. This is, in fact, I don't even have to write three of them. Two of them will do, right? But this is basically your dynamic Bayesian network for this example where I'm in the nuclear bunker wondering whether it's raining and I'm observing this guy coming in with an umbrella or not each day, okay? So you've got a transition on the hidden state rain given the prior state. This is known as a transition model because this is telling you how much noise, how much uncertainty there is in the process of change, right? In this case, a fair bit, right? So the probability that it's raining now, given it was raining the day before, is 0.7. And the probability it's raining now, given it wasn't the day before, is 0.3. Okay, so it would be almost entirely uninformative if these were both 0.5. Then it wouldn't tell you much about rain at all. Okay? And here is the degree of noise between my current hidden variable and my current evidence. If it's raining, then the probability he'll bring his umbrella is 0.9. So there is that 10% of cases that are like a positive, a false negative, if you like, a false positive, if you like, on his umbrella bringing. And if it's not raining, then 80% of the time he won't bring his umbrella, and 20% of the time he will. On that day. And there is no direct link between umbrella carrying today and umbrella carrying yesterday, but there is a link via the rain variables. Right? So on observing that he carried his umbrella yesterday, that will, if you're here, influence your prediction about whether he's going to carry it tomorrow. Okay, it is informative for that because they are linked. In fact, every variable in this kind of network is indirectly linked to every other variable. Okay? Any question? Okay. So quite often, this sort of Markov assumption is massively simplistic and therefore inaccurate, right? The two aspects of it, the fact that we're treating transitions as stationary, constant across time. In other words, this probability table never changes this month, next month, or in 100 years. And the idea that, you know, well, in the case of the first order Markov assumption, that the current state, rain today depends only on rain yesterday, you know, in some domains, that's wildly inaccurate. So with pos tagging, for example, that's part of speech tagging in natural language, for example, that's wildly inaccurate. But quite often good enough to give you good enough results. And it certainly makes the problem tractable. So as per usual, in any of these problems in AI, what you're trying to do is find an optimal balance between the complexity of the model and the cost of inference and learning that model on the one hand, and capturing as accurately and as richly as possible all the causal, all the dependencies you have in your system. There's always some kind of compromise you have to reach there. If you decide that the model is too simple, you can essentially add hidden variables to avoid, to bypass a situation where you go to unbounded models with, you know, hidden, with this sort of transition model changing over time. So for example, with rain, if you think it's just not good enough to say that the probability of rain today, given rain yesterday, is the same in July as it is in November or April, if you're not happy with that, then just add another hidden variable for the month of the year. Okay? So you can do that and avoid, and in that way, you know, maintain your stationary process assumption. But of course, you are increasing the number of hidden variables, and that's more stuff to learn if you're training, if you're learning this model from training data. And once you've got your model, it's more stuff to handle when you want to perform inference with that model. Okay. So now we're going to think about inference. And there are various classes of inference. And here's where the maths gets hairy. So roller coaster ride time, I'm afraid. And there's just sort of no avoiding it. I'll try my best to make it as simple as possible. Right. So here's a bunch of jargon about the types of queries you might be interested in. This first one is known as filtering or monitoring, and that is, what is the hidden state now, given the sequence of evidence variables I have observed from the beginning up till now? Okay, so suppose it's Friday, and I have observed my boss coming in with an umbrella every day, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. And what I'm interested in is it raining today, namely Friday? That's called filtering. Okay. So I'll talk in a minute about how you calculate this. And actually, this calculation is almost identical to this calculation, which is known as likelihood. That's your prior estimate of what evidence you're going to observe before you've observed it, if you like. Okay. Prediction is where you're interested in whether it's going to rain tomorrow, given what you've observed up till now. Okay? So I'm interested in the value of some future state. Maybe it's not tomorrow, maybe it's Monday of next week, given some evidence variables taking me up to a time t that is before the state, the time where I'm interested in my hidden state's value. So that's prediction, for obvious reasons, it's called that. The next one's known as, in Russell and Norvig, for some reason they call it smoothing, a really, really bad term for this. It's also in the literature called hindsight. The reason calling it smoothing is a bad term is because smoothing in this kind of statistical literature in machine learning refers to something entirely different, which is how you estimate probabilities given you know that your sample space for learning from is sparse, with lots of events that, while rare, did not happen. right? So people have to do this in AI a lot, right? They do a calculation called smoothing, which is assigning non-zero probabilities to events you never saw in your training data. That's what it's about. But here, it means something completely different, which is, given the evidence, I've observed this guy with his umbrella Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, and I'm sitting here on Friday, and I'm now wondering, did it rain on Monday? Okay, so this is about estimating the value of some past state given evidence that takes me from before that past state, potentially, through that past state to now, and now is before that past state, right? So that's why hindsight really is a better word for it. In hindsight, given what I know now, right, given the evidence I've got now, in particular the sequence of evidence I've got now, what do I think about what happened last Wednesday? Okay? And then most likely explanation is going for a sequence of values of your hidden state given the sequence of evidence variables. So this, for example, is what you want to do with speech recognition. The evidence will be waves, right? Sound waves. What you want is the most likely sequence of words given your sound waves. Okay? Okay, so here we go with the maths. Right, so let's look at filtering and prediction first. So that's this chap here. What I want to show you is that given the maths of the situation, of Bayes' rule, and of the assumptions we've made about conditional independence, this turns out to be a recursive function. In other words, somewhere in the calculation, you're going to end up with a probability of xt given e 1 to t. In fact, you can see it down here. Okay? Here's how it goes, right? So here's the thing I want to know, right? It's the probability of the next state, value of the next state, xt plus 1. The probability of xt plus 1 given my sequence of evidence. So this is the state now, given my sequence of evidence from the beginning up till now. Okay? Now, all I've done here is split off my last evidence thing from the sequence. Okay? This next line is an application of Bayes' rule. Can everyone see that? Because this conditional probability, let's do it real slow, right? That conditional probability is some normalized version of the joint on my three things, because I've split off that last evidence, right? Which is alpha. Now I'm just going to apply Bayes' rule, right? And I make it e t plus 1 given x t plus 1 e 1 to t, probability of x t plus 1 given e 1 to t, okay? And that is, this thing is the probability of x t plus 1 given e 1 to t times the probability of e 1 to t, right? That's Bayes' rule again. Okay, are you with me so far? Hands up, yes. Oh, there are some people without hands up. Okay. All right, now. This is just a number, this is given, this isn't a distribution. So I can just sort of factor it into my alpha. I'll end up normalizing, when I normalize, I'll take that into account, right? So that is what I've written here. Okay? Okay, you with me so far? Now, let's look at this guy. Now, remember what we said, look at this diagram. Your evidence variable now is conditionally independent of everything else given its parent, okay? And in particular, it's conditionally independent of the evidence before it given this parent. And that's great news because here we've got its parent in the conditioning guy in the condition here, which means I can delete him, right? This equals that because of that conditional independence. And this is what we had up here, okay? So that's the Markov property, yes.
Are we just factoring it out, or is it?
It's just not relevant, mm-hmm. right? That's the definition of conditional independence, right? Z is conditionally independent of Y given X if this equality is true, okay? And my current E is independent of the past E's given the current state. So all I've done is that, okay? Yeah, okay, right. So now we're down here. Now what I'm gonna do is take this conditional probability and I'm going to marginalize into it the prior hidden state, okay? So that gives you this, right, let's get a rubber. All right, so now what I wanna do is work out this guy, right? Xt plus one given E one to t. Now, I can marginalize on the prior state. Okay? That is this by Bayes' rule. Yeah? And that's what's written up there. Okay? But the T plus one hidden state is conditionally independent of evidence given the prior guy. Yeah? So I can rub him out. And that's the last line. Now, this is brilliant. The reason this is brilliant is because, I mean, brilliant computationally. It's really great the maths works out this way because that's filtering function, right? It's the prior calculation. What we started with was a T plus one, right? A sequence of T plus one evidence variables. I want to know the current state. Here's my sequence of T evidence variables. I want to know the XT. It's just the same calculation, but on T instead of T plus one, hence the recursion. This you read directly off the transition model, and this is the sensor model. That's what I mean by this being a weighted average over a recursive calculation. Weighted average because we have this sum. Okay? And that's what makes computing this, however big your T, linear on T. And you can calculate this, the algorithms, you know, you use dynamic programming to get this, right? So it's totally divide and conquer. Now, filtering, so another way of saying this is that when you're looking at this, what you're doing is you're passing a message forward, is the way people think about it. And so you write this forward message as what you're working out is the message you got so far for your XT state, and you increment to it your next bit of evidence, ET plus one. Okay? In other words, this is the thing you're factoring in. You're factoring in the likelihood of your ET plus one given your sensor plus the transition to your sort of the transition given by your XT plus one, given your XT, right? And that's essentially the forward message. And it's linear, it's brilliant. That's why people use this all the time. All right, so let's look at our example then. First of all, we've got to set, and our example is essentially this, but there's one more piece of information you need to know, which is what's the value of R0? Okay?
Because here what we've got is a conditional probability table of RT given RT minus 1. So that's fine for R1, but what about R0? We don't have an R minus 1, right? So you've got to just, as well as this, specify the prior for your hidden variable, the R0. I'm just going to set it to completely ignorant, right? 0.5 it's true, 0.5 it's not. Okay? Right, let's predict R1. So what I'm going to do is predict it's raining on Tuesday, given that the umbrellas came in on Monday and Tuesday. So the probability of R1, I can marginalize out on R0, and it's basically this calculation. I get this 0.7 and 0.3. That's the probability that R is true, given the prior guy was true. And the current guy is false, given the prior guy is true. Okay, that's what that 0.7, 0.3 is. And then the 0.3, 0.7 is that it's raining today, given it wasn't raining yesterday, and not raining today, given it wasn't raining yesterday. And we get 0.5, 0.5 again. Now we update this prior with our evidence from day one. So the probability of R1 given U1 is this by Bayes. Now, this I've just calculated, it's 0.5, 0.5. This is the sensor model, okay? So I'm reading that 0.9, 0.2 off here. And that's approximately this, okay? Now, this is the recursive bit of the function for 1. If you look at this formula, that's essentially what you get, is this calculation, is the recursive bit for 1. Now we're in day 2. Now, according to that formula back there, right, it's going to be the probability of U2 given R2 times summing over R1, the probability of R2 given R1, probability of R1 given U1. So let's do the R2 given R1, R1 given U1 sum first, right? Which is this bit of the formula here, when we plug it in, okay? And it's this bunch of stuff. So the R2 given R1, that's the sensor model. The R1 given U1, I've just worked out. I'm dealing with R1 being true here, so that's 0.818. I get that off here. And this is now the case where R1 is false. So this is the transition model again, with R1 false. And since R1, and now we're looking at the probability of not R1 given U1. So that's that number. Okay, turns out to be this. So that's our first bit of the sum, that's this bit. Now what we have to do is multiply it with the sensor bit, the U2 given R2. Oops. Right, here's the U2 given R2 is 0.9, 0.2, that's off the sensor model. You do pointwise, the pointwise product, and in the end, it's this. So your belief that it's raining today is really high, right? And higher than it would be if all you were basing it on was the umbrella today. It would be 0.818, actually, if you were basing it only on the umbrella today and nothing else. But no, because you saw the umbrella today and you saw it yesterday, it's gone up a bit. Because rain yesterday makes rain today more likely. And the umbrella happening yesterday is positive evidence for rain yesterday. Okay? So it's gone up a bit. All right. Okay. So that's monitoring. Here is prediction. Now, prediction again, the computation of going from this to this model is much like it was for the monitoring case, right? You apply Bayes' rule, you exploit conditional independence,
and you find that you've got this recursive function. It's essentially a weighted average on the recursion. And so it's recursive because, look, we're going back in time here with our hidden variable, right? So this is prediction of our future state t plus k, given our evidence up to t. And it's the future state, our prediction of t plus k plus 1 is a function of our prediction on xt plus k, given this evidence 1 to t, weighted with the transition model. Now, the more noise there is in transition, in other words, the less you know about a current hidden state given a prior hidden state, the quicker predictions won't take evidence into account at all, and they'll sort of stabilize out into just the prior for the hidden state, right? So the more noise there is in this, right, and the less informative the last hidden state is for the current one, the quicker you end up heading towards the probability distribution essentially of x0. And that's, so this is known as a stationary distribution, right? So you'll sort of, as you predict, right, suppose I've got evidence up to here. Well, I may have lots of really, and here's, I don't want that line. So here's, I do want that line. Here's naught, here's one, right, the probabilities, and I've got evidence up to here. And I may have really strong beliefs about my hidden variable, and it's going, you know, like this. If you've got, now I stop having evidence, if there's loads of uncertainty given your transition models, then you'll very quickly head towards the prior, which I made zero for some reason in this case, right? If there's lots of certainty, it will much more gradually decay to the prior over time. That wasn't a great diagram, but you get the idea. You'll either go go back to the prior very quickly or very slowly, depending on the nature of the transition model. Okay. Now, with likelihood, so this is where you want to work out the sequence of, this is where you want to know some prior, compute the likelihood of a given evidence sequence. Now, this is really important for learning. Okay, where what you're trying to do is learn the transition and sensor model. Okay, it's basically it's this calculation that people use in learning. What you're trying to do, because they try and maximize this value, right? They're trying to maximize the probability that you saw what you did by rigging the transition and sensor models so that this is as big as it could be, right? Barring smoothing. In the machine learning sense rather than the hindsight sense. Now, so what you do with this is you sort of take the joint distribution, the monitoring one, and it turns out this is a recursive function as well, right? So the likelihood from 1 to t, from 1 to t plus 1 is a function of the likelihood of 1 to t with an incremental calculation for ET plus 1. And in fact, what you do is you, at each stage, marginalize out the hidden variable. And I'm going to carry on in the same vein next time. We'll look at some more calculations, and in particular, we'll look at hindsight next time. But they all kind of work in the same way. You are exploiting Bayes rule, conditional independence, and trying to aim for a mathematical equation that makes the calculation recursive. And you can do it with all these kinds of queries. They are all recursive. And that's fantastic news because it makes inference of linear complexity. Any questions? Yeah. A zero-order Markov
model is, it's like having a static model, right? And third order looks like this. So and you'd have guys coming out like that, right? So you would need, each one of these arcs would need its own transition thing. It's a bit, well, no, that's not true. Basically, the transition model then has, sorry, I'll start again. You've got one transition model, but there are more rows to it, right? Because you have to consider every combination of the parent, the grandparent, and the great-grandparent, because they're all parents. Yeah, so it's just a thing with more rows. It doesn't, I mean, it makes the maths more complex, but it is still a recursive function. There's just going to be more in it. But don't worry about anything above first order for the purposes of this course. Any more questions? Okay, see you tomorrow.
Guys, just a quick notice. On Monday, there's the Informatics 2 Student Liaison meeting. So if you have any thoughts on any of the courses, please talk to your class reps, for instance, to me for this course. Any thoughts are appreciated. Thanks.
Thank you.